I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. One thing that doesn't change about Americans is our need to blow things up on Independence Day. Less predictable is how we choose to define patriotism. It's a concept that has sustained our country's 243 years, but what does it mean to you? Today, chime in and let us know what you think makes a patriot as we look at the evolution of patriotism throughout American history. Then, computer design, research, and programming are largely male-dominated industries, but women have been absolutely instrumental in creating that little tool we use every day, the Internet. We'll learn about some of those women and how they're still influencing tech as we get you up to date after this hour's news. It was 243 years ago yesterday when a group of colonists banded together to break their ties to English rule. These founding fathers and those who joined the revolution against Britain were our first patriots. Since the signing of the Declaration of Independence, love of country has been tested throughout American history, but has it changed what it means to be a patriot? Joining me now to help answer those questions, Max Skidmore. He's the Curator's Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Thomas Jefferson Fellow at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Max, thanks for being here.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
We're going to want to know what you define or how you define patriotism. And if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. So, Max, patriotism during the American Revolution was divided between two political models, monarchy and self-rule. There were the patriots, there were Tories. Did anybody really know when they started down that revolutionary road how to make a republic work?
Well, it was, as they would say in modern times, a time in which they played it by ear. They improvised as they proceeded. And the founders had a pretty good idea of what they wanted, but it took a lot of pushing and hauling and shoving and compromising to get it implemented, to get what they did want. Thomas Jefferson captured it beautifully in the Declaration of Independence, but the Constitution, when it came to be written, is a more difficult thing to come up with because you actually have to be responsible for what you say, and you can't just talk in broad generalities. You have to be precise, and what you do affects people's lives. The Tories, I'm sure, thought of themselves as patriotic English subjects, and the revolutionaries thought of themselves as revolutionary patriots. A lot is in the eye of the beholder. The term patriotism is related somewhat to the term nationalism. There's a lot of similarity. The term patriotism is older. Basically, it means, as you had said, love of country. Nationalism is more nuanced, and it has taken over kind of a bad connotation in modern times because of its association with hate groups and white nationalism and so forth. But it's oversimplified to say patriotism good, nationalism bad.
When did they break away? I mean, nationalism has had a little bit of a difficult definition going back to the 20s and 30s, going
yes.
into World War II. When did they diverge?
Well, that's about when they did diverge, in the 20s, 30s, on into World War II. Fascism specifically, and Nazism as a variant of fascism specifically, incorporated as one of their key principles what they called an integral nationalism, meaning a very exaggerated, rigid definition of us versus them and love of country or party or the folk or the leader, depending on which variation you looked at. But a little bit prior to that, in 1910, former President Theodore Roosevelt, in probably the most important speech of his life right down the road in Osawatomie, Kansas, gave a stem-winding talk to standing on a kitchen table in the middle of a field, and if you can believe 30,000 people showing up for that in Osawatomie in 1910, given transportation difficulties and all that, he outlined his program, which became the foundation for his Bull Moose run to try to get back in the presidency in 1912. And it outlined such things as unemployment insurance and Social Security and health care for all, minimum wage, the kinds of things that at least a generation passed before any of them became real, and the vote for women, which did become real in within a decade or so after that. He called it his new nationalism. It did not have the unpleasant connotation then that has developed later. But the terms flow from the notion of patriotic, which we got from the French and they got from the ancient Greeks, land of my fathers, love of your own land. Nation, on the other hand, is a more of a psychological phenomenon. Country or state is a territorial thing. You have a division in boundaries and all. Nationalism is a sense. It's what exists among a very large group of people who believe they belong together for some because of some historical or it can be religious, it can be linguistic, it can be racial, it can be geographic, it can be all kinds of things.
In the United States of America, it's all of those things,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that's why we've combined it into what we now call nation-state, and that we tend to use terms so loosely that people think of nation and country as being the same thing. They really don't mean the same thing at all. The prime expression of patriotism in modern times, so far as I'm concerned, was in John Kennedy's great inaugural address when he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." It wasn't too long before that would be seen as naive when politicians were saying, "Vote for me, I'll let you keep more of your hard-earned money. You can spend it better than government can," which is a little dubious if you want a superhighway or interstate or something of that kind. But anyway, it was an appeal to selfishness subsequently, but Kennedy was appealing to a sense of civic responsibility, a sense that we're in this all in this together. That we have an obligation to our country, and that means to the other people in the country, not just to ourselves selfishly.
You know, it wasn't too long after that that you started to hear America, love it or leave it.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, is that patriotic? Is it nationalism? Is it a little of both?
Well, that's an instance of nationalism gone astray, I would say. And even at best, nationalism is a political ideology, and it's compatible with any other kind of ideology. Democracy or Karl Marx believed that a mechanic in Afghanistan had more in common with mechanic in France or Kansas than with managers and so forth. And he was wrong. He ignored the pull of nationalism. The mechanic in Kansas thinks of herself or himself as an American or Kansan American. In France, he thinks of himself as a Frenchman, in Afghanistan, and so forth. Nationalism trumped everything, no pun intended, and it can be accommodated by any kind of political ideology. But when it comes to love it or leave it, it reflects an unhealthy tendency in any kind of very strong nationalism, which is line drawing, wall building, if you will. People on this side, good. People on that side, bad, even if the wall was only built last week.
My guest is Max Skidmore. He's a distinguished professor of political science at UMKC. We're talking about patriotism. Do you have a historical figure that you see as a real patriot and why? Tweet us at KCOR Up to Date, or you can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. I'm going to move on to the Civil War, which I think drastically changed,
yes,
our thought of what a patriot is, and maybe divided that patriotism in a way that I think we still feel today.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about that.
Well, it incorporated a notion, unfortunately, of racism. slavery turned on the whole question of race, inferiority, superiority, control of another population. And prior to the Civil War, it was very common. You don't hear this usage very often today. You hear of the Union and the State of the Union message, but usually you refer to the country or the nation or something rather than the Union. But you also, if you think about it, the United States of America doesn't, in the same way that many other countries do, have an actual name. It's just a description. They are the United States in North America, and there are other countries in South America and all that. But prior to the Civil War, my understanding is it was pretty common to use the term the United States as a plural.
The United States are.
The United States are. They constitute a great country, if you think in terms of country. Also, there was probably more tendency to think of yourself as a citizen of a state. After the Civil War, which cut a wide swath through American history, just like the French Revolution did through Western history, and things were different after the Civil War, just as they were different after the French Revolution throughout the whole of Western civilization. We now ungrammatically use the United States as a singular, which is clearly a plural formulation. But we say the United States is a powerful country. It's a great country. It reflects love of country. You don't say they reflect love of country. And the Civil War probably set that in motion more than anything else. It became common in the First World War for Americans abroad to refer to themselves as Americans, not as Kansans or as Mississippians or as New Yorkers.
So as we move forward from that, so we've got a divided nation. The South, for some time, even after the Civil War, continued to somewhat fight it. Jim Crow laws come into effect. So you've got this divided nation, and I'm wondering, did it come back together for World War I, or was it still? It still feels to me like it was somewhat divided.
Well, yes and no. It did come together somewhat. People like Theodore Roosevelt, like Woodrow Wilson, who were antagonists, by the way, did strongly emphasize national unity. And Roosevelt's presidency helped solidify the country east and west at a time when the wounds were still raw, almost bleeding, north and south. But the power of the division was so great. You would think that if there's anything in anyone's personal life that would supersede everything, it's religion, an ultimate concern. And yet, churches split. You had Southern Baptists split off from American Baptists. You had Southern Methodists split off from other Methodists. And much of that still exists. These divisions exist. The Southern Baptist Church is, I believe, the largest single denomination in the country. Well, probably Roman Catholics would be somewhat larger, but it's a very, very large denomination, and it's identified as a sectional group. It obviously isn't limited to the South, but the fact that politics, again, trumped religion in that sense. Your religion had to follow your politics.
816-235-2888 is how you join our conversation. So it seems to me that it feels anyway the last time that the country was completely together for any long period of time was World War II, where there actually was an existential threat to the homeland. I'm not so sure in World War I that threat necessarily existed, but it certainly did in World War II. And do you think that the definition of patriotism changed in World War II, or did it become imperative that we all sort of have the same definition?
I think it did change. I think it became stronger, but only at the expense of incorporating some of the least savory aspects of the formerly divided country. The military was segregated. The whole country was segregated, particularly in the South, less so outside the South, but it was there. Brown versus Board of Education came from Kansas,
right,
not from the South.
Mm-hmm.
And Berkeley was segregated at one time and all. And we had the horrible phenomenon of the Japanese incarceration in concentration camps simply because of having chosen the wrong ancestor. People who were native-born American citizens were incarcerated simply because of who they were, what their ancestry was.
Can I just jump in and ask, mm-hmm. is that a result of nationalism taking over from patriotism?
I think it is, and it's a reflection of the racial basis and bias incorporated into nationalism, because you didn't have the same kind of separation with regard to German people of German extraction or Italian extraction in the United States, but you certainly did with people who were
different
Japanese. You could identify them by color. And you have to be careful, though, not to assume that we're uniquely evil. It was an evil act, but it wasn't a uniquely evil act. My understanding is that on the West Coast, in British Columbian and Canadian provinces, they did the same thing. They are not the United States. So there are tragedies throughout history. We have a great country that has done marvelous things and has done horrible things, and it's part. We need to confront our whole history and accept the parts that are good, be apologetic for the parts that are not good, and vow to continue along the most justifiable lines possible.
So as we go into the Vietnam War, patriotism, I think, changes again, that there is even more of a challenge to the government to
yes.
you know, what it means to be a patriot.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you believe that there were patriots on both sides, those who went to Vietnam to fight and those who fought against the war.
Absolutely. I think both of them did so out of love of country. War protesters, not in every case, but in most cases, war protesters were putting their futures on the line for principles that they thought should be and officially were the principles of the country. Principles go back to the Declaration of Independence. Lincoln was probably the first president who emphasized the Declaration even beyond the Constitution. And his interpretation of patriotism and of the principles of the Declaration that infused the country, not that they always had been adhered to, but because they were the standard that we aspired to, and that it would lead the country ultimately in the direction of a country that incorporates racial justice, and I don't want to use the term tolerance because that implies sufferance of the majority and all that. But the long-term thrust of the country tends to be good, but you can't be a true patriot if you look only at what we've done good, because then you cannot recognize what we've done that isn't so good and recognize the need for change any more than you can look only at what we have done, genocide of the native populations, slavery, and so forth, and say, oh, we're uniquely evil because we're guilty of those things. Human history is a history of great tragedy. Anytime different groups mingle, you have tragic situations, particularly when one is technologically superior to the other, or more greedy than the other, or more interested in setting aside principles than the other, as is always the case to some extent. It's one thing to recognize this and to try to avoid it, and another thing to deny it, and another thing to lose completely all sense of attachment because you're so despondent over injustices in the past.
So where are we now, do you think, in the world of patriotism? I'm interested to hear how you would define a patriot in 2019.
I would not define it as someone who argues that anyone who steps across that line is committing an evil act and deserves to be treated inhumanely. Nor would you accept the definition of those who are especially concerned about that as saying that, if you don't agree with me, you believe in no controls whatever, open borders. That doesn't follow, but you can convince people using fallacious arguments.
Patriotism always seems to be a moving target,
isn't
it?
Yes, that's true. And it, like many other things, can be defined differently. And different people, it reflects people's own personal views. Patriotism to a German is probably different from patriotism to a French citizen. Patriotism to an American is a bit different from patriotism to a Canadian or a Mexican. Patriotism in the United States is probably different if you are a Vermonter or a Mississippian. And one of our great strengths is variation, variety, and diversity. Without that, we aren't America.
Max Skidmore, Curator's Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Thomas Jefferson Fellow at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thanks for being with me. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure.
Coming up, the untold stories of the women who made the Internet. I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Earlier this week on KCUR's Up to Date, Steve Kraske spoke to Kansas Governor Laura Kelly about her first 6 months in office. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Kraske's back on Monday for a discussion about changing attitudes in Kansas about marijuana and hemp, learn about the first year of legal hemp production in the state, and the possibility of medical marijuana. That's Monday on Up to Date.
The earth is on fire. We don't have no daughter. Let the mother father burn. We're all hungry, we're all tired.
It's not very often we get to start an author interview segment with music from the author, but we get to do that today. That's from Yacht's NPR Tiny Desk Concert in 2011, and that's Claire Evans on vocals, and she joins me now via Skype from L.A. Claire, thanks for being on Up to Date.
Delighted to be here.
You know, we're not talking music today, though. Evans is the author of Broadband, The Untold Story of Women Who Made the Internet. Claire, I want to talk about if your music and your writing intersect a little bit later, but first, I want to start where you started in the book. And that's with a WAN ad for computers, and we're not talking about hardware. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, for close to 200 years, a computer wasn't a thing. It was a job, as in someone who computes, who performs computations for a living. Same is true for the word calculator, for that matter. It was a job that was performed mostly by women for a very long time, doing the important sort of groundwork of the scientific age, and it was only until the beginning of World War II that the computer became a physical object, which not coincidentally was programmed and staffed by the women that had been doing that work up until that point. So there's a long, deep, and profound history connecting women with tech, and that's what I explore in the book.
It generated a term that I circled in the book, and that was kilo girls.
Yes.
And I want you to explain that, because I think that's the kind of thing that gets caught in your porn filter now.
Yes. yes. So women were so intrinsic to the act of doing computational work that by the time mechanical computers came around, scientists who were using computations would refer to the amount of time they took to process problems in, you know, girl hours. And they would talk about how many kilo girls a mechanical computer was worth, because, you know, the idea of doing this kind of work was so, so deeply connected to female bodies and minds.
Yeah. How is it that women got into this line of work? There was, you know, probably a time when they were, you know, especially before in the 19th century, women would be teachers, they would be domestics. But how did they end up in the world of computing, huge rows of figures?
Well, I mean, it's important to remember that this was not work that was considered to be important at all. I mean, glamorous anyway. It wasn't as serious or important as being a mathematician. It was really sort of the brunt work of computational work. It was doing all those tiny, small, tedious, repetitive calculations that were necessary to, you know, calculate ballistics trajectories or, you know, handle maritime navigations, the kinds of things that people who were seriously interested in becoming mathematicians were not going to waste their time with. So it was this kind of intellectual labor, this kind of brunt labor, and that is essentially why women were permitted to do it. It wasn't seen as something that had any possibility for advancement. So if you were sort of a technically inclined or mathematically inclined young woman in the 19th century or the early 20th century, you know, it was a good alternative to being a teacher or being a secretary. You know, it was something that you could do that used your mind, but certainly promised no possibility for serious advancement.
I want to mention that Claire is going to be at the Central Library 6:30 on Monday to talk about her book, Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. You can RSVP at kclibrary.org. You know, you say it's unimportant, but good golly, these women helped win World War II, not just with calculating, you know, where a shell from a tank is going to fall, but also in breaking codes. I mean, maybe it's not glamorous, but good golly, it was important.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's a pattern that comes up again and again in this history where there's a job that's considered to be necessary but not glamorous. And that is a job that is given to women. For example, early computer programming was a job that was handed to women because they'd already been doing the math, you know, for two centuries at that point. And, you know, it didn't seem like it was any more important than, you know, patching cables like a telephone operator. The really important thing was the hardware, not the software. But as soon as women entered into that space and applied themselves and actually addressed the work and came up with ways to make the work easier, to streamline the work, came up with programming languages and intermediaries and compilers, all of a sudden it became important, or at least it became seen as being important. And that's kind of when you start to see women getting pushed out. So that has happened many times in the history of computing. Women enter this sort of, you know, unglamorous space. They do incredible work. It becomes seen as the value that it has, and then women are sort of pushed out. And you know, I hope that if we understand history well enough, we can stop repeating that pattern over and over again. But yes, they won the war in many ways. I mean, they ran the ship.
I want to come back to that notion of women being pushed out, but I want to talk about two women right now that that I particularly enjoyed in the book, and that's Ada Lovelace and Grace Hopper. Certainly not contemporaries. There's many, 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 many years between them, but I was really sucked into both of their stories. So first, tell me a little bit about Ada Lovelace.
So Ada Lovelace is a super interesting character just in her own right. She was the daughter of the poet Lord Byron, who was this kind of, you know, very sort of romantic, tempestuous, problematic guy. And because her father was so shady, her mother, who was sort of the opposite, she was this sort of very sort of serious woman. She kind of put Ada into rigorous mathematical training from a really young age because she wanted to make sure that she didn't inherit any of the sort of romantic tendencies of her famously louche poet father. And so she became this obsessive mathematical hermit as a child. And she studied mathematics with some of the most luminary figures of her day via correspondence, of course, because she couldn't actually go to school. And she ended up meeting a British scientist named Charles Babbage in 1833 when she was a teenager. And Babbage had been building these kind of steampunky early computing machines. I mean, really machines, like gears and all stamped out of metal. And nobody really understood his machines or could wrap their heads around what they were for. But Ada was one of the few people who saw it and recognized, you know, the beauty of the invention, the potential of the invention. And she threw herself into popularizing, explaining, you know, helping Charles Babbage in whatever way she could, so that people would understand the importance of these machines. And she ended up writing a number of technical papers and mathematical proofs for these machines, which constitute essentially the first computer programs ever written. So a century and change before the invention of the modern computer. As we know it, this woman was writing computer programs that would be recognizable to modern day computer scientists. So she was really brilliant and super ahead of her time. And she understood inherently how computers were not just going to be these number crunching machines, but they were going to be machines that we could use to process symbolic information. I mean, she was even writing about using computers to make music in 1840. So she was really a remarkable human being.
You know, one of the, and I don't know if I saw it in your book or I saw it on the internet, but there's a picture of Grace Hopper in her Navy uniform that that I really liked. I mean, this petite woman and who left a huge footprint, I don't know, in the United States Navy, but certainly in computing. So tell me the Grace Hopper story.
Well, Grace Hopper is a giant as well. She called herself the third programmer of the first computer. So she was hired during World War II, sight unseen, to work on the Harvard Mark I, which is one of the earliest electromechanical computers. And it's important to remember that in these days, there was no precedent at all. There were no instruction manuals. There were, you know, there were no tutorials for programmers. You came face to face with a massive room-sized machine. And, you know, she had a mathematics education, and she was told basically, put math on this thing that you've never seen before in your life. And she had no engineering background. So she basically had to reverse engineer, if you will, an understanding of how this computer worked by taking components apart and studying wiring diagrams. And eventually she understood its workings, you know, as well as, if not better than, the engineers who had built it. And she ended up, running incredibly important ballistics and cryptography calculations. One of the central calculations for the implosion of the atomic bomb was run on a Harvard Mark I computer. So she was intrinsic, really, to the war effort. And in doing so, she was instrumental in the development of early programming languages. She invented the first compiler. She came up with strategies for streamlining the work that are kind of still in use today. And then after the war, she ran the programming team on one of the most important major early commercial computers, the UNIVAC. So, she gets a lot of credit for being this important figure during World War II, which she absolutely was. But she was in the computing industry until she was in her late 80s. I mean, she was building computing systems for tactical Navy submarine deployment when she was in her 80s. So she was someone who was an absolute force of nature.
Claire Evans, who is the author of Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet, is my guest. She's joining me via Skype from, where are you, by the way?
I'm in Los Angeles, California.
How's the weather there?
It's okay. I don't know how it is where you guys are for the 4th of July, but it gets really kind of apocalyptic here on the 4th. A lot of illegal fireworks, so it's very smoky in the air this morning.
It gets a little apocalyptic here, depending on where you're at. So I found myself thinking when I was reading about Ada and Grace about, you know, is one of them the godmother or the Sacagawea of the internet, or is there somebody else that you would give that honor to?
Wow. Well, I think, you know, it's funny. I think one of the things that I was attracted to when I was writing these stories was trying to create an alternative to the sort of great man histories of technology. And I discovered in the process of doing so that the alternative to a great man history isn't necessarily a great woman history. It's actually something a lot more nuanced and complex and sort of collective, really, because, you know, the history of technology, like the history of anything, is the story of people in groups, enmeshed, collaborating in conflict, driven by their own desires, perhaps, but still working together in sort of, especially in the history of tech, because tech is such a sort of, you know, to achieve great things in technology, you kind of need a lot of people working together over time. So I think the thing that's fascinating to me is seeing how all of these people sort of play together and how a lot of the most important developments in this history emerge from collective effort over great time. So I don't know that there's a Sacagawea necessarily. There's certain like iconic figures like Grace Hopper, but there's so much more to it all.
I want to go back to this notion of male-dominated history. And there was an effort to keep computer design, research, and programming, it seems to me from reading your book, male-dominated. And you write about a conference where the term computer engineering was coined.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by that because engineering always sort of had a masculine thing, right? You're going to build it. You're a bridge builder or a lock and dam guy or a skyscraper. So by just putting the term engineer next to it, it felt like that was a way to make it continue it as a male-dominated endeavor. Yes, is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a semantic shift, but it's an important one because, you know, for much of the early history of computing programming, you know, it was sort of this field that was populated by rogue individuals and misfits and people who sort of found themselves in this industry because of a certain aptitude for mathematics or because they were good at puzzles or because they worked themselves up from being secretaries. And it was not something that was very formalized or professionalized in any way. And it wasn't really until the mid to late 1960s that it became apparent that computing needed to have sort of more professional rigor. And this shift from, you know, programmer to software engineer, which, you know, comes with all kinds of status and requires certain professional qualifications, certain degrees, certain, you know, affiliations to professional groups. All of that was certainly part of an effort to professionalize the field, and which implicitly also masculinized the field because it ended up pushing people out who perhaps didn't have time or resources to go to school and get the correct degree to do the job that they'd already been doing, or, you know, didn't have the financial resources to enter into these sort of professional organizations and go to conferences because they were taking care of kids or because they were taking care of their families. So it's something that edged the industry towards a more sort of male-dominated environment, which has, of course, kind of persisted until today in confluence with lots of other factors. I mean, it's not just that, of course. You know, wage disparity is a big issue. Lack of access to childcare, lack of mentorship, especially after that first generation of women in the computing field kind of aged out. There's lots of factors working together to kind of edge women out, and we're just beginning now to identify and unlearn a lot of these things and to unlearn this assumption that we have that computing is necessarily male-dominated, an assumption that was really reinforced by, you know, marketing for about 35 years. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, you know, all the representations popularly of what computers were and who computers were for, it was all, you know, nerdy little boys. It was weird science. It was nebbish teenagers programming their dream woman. It was ads for video games that were not really targeted to me. So I think we have a lot of unlearning to do, and it took us a generation to kind of get where we are, and it will probably take another generation to get back.
You know what I liked about reading your book and what you just said. Somewhere in there, you used the word dreck, and you just used nebbish. And I like anybody who drops in a little Yiddish here and there. I think that it really propels the story forward.
Oh, I mean, yes, there's no language more evocative than Yiddish.
Hey, I want to circle back to what I talked about right up the top, and that your life is both an author and a musician. And I'm wondering, and I like to hear about the creative process. So does the process of performing music and writing, because you're not just an author of books, you write for Vice, do those things intersect, or are they two separate disciplines for you?
You know, I think it's really just about communication and finding the right envelope for an idea. I mean, some ideas are best expressed in a pop song, you know, a subversive, short form, poppy, earworm format. And other ideas require kind of a more long form approach. Ultimately, it's all about trying to get a message across. And I think, you know, I feel really lucky that I have a couple of different, completely different avenues for self-expression. But I think that they are really related. I think that, you know, the themes that I explore in my writing often kind of percolate into my music. And while certainly playing music is a form of catharsis when I've been locked in my office for too long working on a book, it's nice to have the opposite thing. But I also think that making books and making records are kind of, it's kind of similar. They require similar outlays of time. You know, you've got a few years of gestation, you're in the lab, then you release something into the world, and you have to enter into this period of life where you're kind of traveling around and performing it or talking about it or reiterating it. And then eventually you go back to the lab and you go back into the cycle, and it goes on and on. And I love that cyclical way of living. I don't have kids, so in a sense it's kind of the only way that I'm able to perceive the passage of time, if that makes sense.
It does make absolute sense, actually. Hey, so you're not a historian by training, but as you went through this book, you clearly had to go through primary source materials. Mm-hmm. And so talk to me about the road to being a historian.
Oh boy! Wow, it's a tough job. Turns out, no. Yeah, I'm not a trained historian. Obviously, I was a journalist for many years, so I know how to sleuth, you know, through materials, and I know how to talk to people. I know how to conduct interviews, and really, I went kind of maximalist in my process since it was my first book. I really wanted to make sure I did a good job, and I'll admit that Broadband began its life essentially as an encyclopedia. I mean, I tracked every woman that I could find. I felt this burden of responsibility to make sure that everyone who had been omitted from all the other histories, of which there are many, was included in my book. So I dug through old websites, through books, through scholarly articles, newspaper archives. I asked everybody that I interviewed, you know, who else should I talk to? I zeroed in on every footnote and every existing history that I could find, just looking for women's names, you know, just looking for women's names. And with the suspicion, often correct, there was usually a lot more to their stories than was being told in the short footnote in the other book about the famous guys. So there are a lot of people that I eventually sort of added to my master list. And even now, you know, a year and change since the book has been published, I still find new people that I hadn't heard of, or people tell me about their grandmothers or great-grandmothers who were involved in the industry in some way. So there's just an unbelievable wealth of material, which makes it almost more maddening that so many times the story has been told without including these stories, because there's just so much there. But for a book to do its job, it has to be readable. It has to be a narrative. So I ended up narrowing my lists down quite significantly to the people who I felt were most representative of the larger themes at play in the history. You know, so for every woman that's featured in my book, you know, just imagine that there's 25 to 50 other women who were doing similar jobs. But the one I chose maybe had the most kind of compelling narrative, or was the most, you know, proficient at describing the experience of the sort of larger history that I wanted to track. So there's always more, and I hope that somebody writes a sequel. I hope many sequels are written.
So I'm wondering, is there a story that you ran across, or one that you have discovered since the publication of the book that you desperately wish you could have gotten into the book? Maybe not desperately.
Oh boy. Yes, absolutely. I really wanted to write about user interface design. I don't know how much I want to get into the weeds right now.
Get into the weeds.
But, you know, the thing that was important for me with the book was I didn't want to just write about technical women. I didn't want to just write about programmers. I wanted to make sure that, you know, women saw themselves reflected, you know, even if they were creative, or even if they were, you know, game designers or hackers, or, you know, there's many different ways of interfacing with this technology, many different approaches that are equally valid, I think. And I didn't want it to just be a sort of hard-nosed technical book. I would have really liked to have written about user interface design, you know, the study and practice of creating, you know, the actual interfaces that we delve into when we use software, because those are the parts of the technology that touch us most directly and that think about, you know, human beings and try to make space for human beings in the most sort of explicit way. And I kind of discovered near the end of the process of writing the book and afterwards that was a field that had been dominated by women for a really, really long time. And some of the most important user interface designers have been women, and also, you know, designers of fonts and icons and all these sort of, you know, more superficial seeming but actually very important components of software. For example, the great Susan Kare, who worked at Apple in the 80s and designed all the icons and fonts for the original Macintosh computer. I would have loved to talk to her, and I suppose I'll have to save that for another book.
Is there what on the web today do you really like that embraces what Grace Hopper wanted information technology to be?
Oh boy. Well, I hate to be doom and gloom about these things. I think that there's not a ton on the web today that really, I think, expresses the utopian aspirations of the earliest programmers and the earliest designers of computing networks and the earliest web designers. I think that we've entered into this really siloed, hyper-capitalized, hyper-surveilled, you know, very, very few choices and options for personalization and for freedom. We're in a really weird moment right now where the gatekeepers are I can count them on one hand, and they're all watching us. It's certainly the opposite of what a lot of these early computing pioneers would have wanted or would have liked. And I think that's honestly a consequence of scale. I think that, you know, it's one thing to build a community that's equitable and safe and fun if you're talking about building a community for, you know, a few thousand people. But it's unrealistic to imagine that, you know, we can monitor and protect online communities in the billions. I think once we start thinking at that scale, we end up having to outsource a lot of the most problematic aspects of what it means to run a community of people to, you know, moderators who are shunted off into dark rooms and who are experiencing all of the trauma of humanity, bearing it on our behalf. So I'm much more interested still in smaller communities. And I think there's, you know, that pops up here and there on the web, I suppose. I mean, there's like Facebook groups and Slack channels or group email lists or group DMs. I think the smaller the better. I think we are better when we are dealing with, you know, smaller pockets and more direct communities where we're all stakeholders. And yeah. I think it's a lot harder to feel that way when you're, you know, on Facebook and any message that you put out can potentially go out to billions of people who can misinterpret you.
Do you think that something like Wikipedia fills that in?
Yeah, that's fair. I love Wikipedia. I certainly wouldn't be who I am today without Wikipedia. And I think there's a number of stories in the book that I probably would not have discovered had it not been for, you know, some altruistic Wikipedia editor hero who made sure that story was there so that I could begin the research journey. I think it's a massively important resource and always a little bit imperiled. I try to support Wikipedia as much as I can. Yes, Wikipedia is the last good thing online. I'll say that.
We've only got another minute or so, but I want to ask you if you see women floating back to the upper reaches of an industry that they helped shape. Are you optimistic about that?
I am. I think we're in the midst of a larger social sea change where we're starting to recognize the factors that go into making workplaces and schools and groups of people hospitable or inhospitable to women. And we're starting to hold people accountable and we're starting to talk about it more, and it's messy and it's awkward and uncomfortable for a lot of people, but it's real progress. And I think that, you know, if we keep going on this path and we keep addressing the needs of the people who want to be doing the job that they want to be doing, I think we're on our way back. It's going to take a while, but I'm hopeful. Yeah, I'm more hopeful than I used to be.
Claire Evans, author of Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. She's going to be at the Central Library Branch of Kentucky Public Library Monday at 6:30. You can RSVP at kclibrary.org. Claire Evans, I thoroughly enjoyed this. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a good day.
Thanks. You can listen to previous episodes of Up to Date at kcur.org/up-to-date. That includes a conversation this week with Kansas Governor Laura Kelly, who summed up her efforts on prison reform, Medicaid expansion, and school finance. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. I'm Sam Zeff at Sam Zeff. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Monday on the program, the latest thinking among family psychologists about gender identity and why the movement towards acceptance grows and fades, both socially and politically. Our theme music, composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. Kraske is back on Monday. Have a great weekend. I'm Sam Zeff, and you're up to date.